This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
In New Mexico, a frantic emergency call to the police gives hope to a desperate mother that her daughter, kidnapped almost 7 years ago, is still alive. Several years ago, a retired couple in Florida offered food and comfort to a poor itinerant stranger. Later, in the midst of their own hard times, their good deed was rewarded by a generous, unknown benefactor. Just before Christmas in 1982, 7-year-old Chucky McGivern is stricken with a rare, often fatal illness. While in a coma, Chucky is visited by a mysterious boy and given the gift of a Christmas miracle. Join me for these stories which capture the spirit of the season on our special holiday edition of Unsolved Mysteries. Even at Christmas time, it is easy to doubt the possibility of miracles unless you believe you have experienced one. The McGivern family of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, never imagined that they would be chosen to receive such a gift. Their remarkable story began during the Christmas season 10 years ago, on the day 7-year-old Chucky McGivern came home early from school with a case of the chicken pox. Three days later, Chucky's brother frantically called his parents upstairs. Chucky had taken a sudden, terrifying turn for the worse.
Chucky?
He had lost consciousness and slipped into a coma.
Chucky, honey, he is ice cold.
I'm gonna call the doctor.
Chucky was immediately rushed to a nearby hospital, his brain dangerously swollen. His parents waited for an hour while doctors stabilized his condition.
The doctor warned me when I went in there. He says, when you see him, he's gonna look like he's dead. His skin was so hard and cold and pure white. And he had all these, he had a bolt sewn into his head. He had tubes in his kidneys and in his, up his nose. The main thing was the bolt that was in his head. And just his liver, everything was just hooked up to everything. And I was shocked. I was really shocked.
Chucky's diagnosis was grim. He had Reye's syndrome, a rare disease of the nervous system, brain, and liver that is virtually unique to children and often fatal.
How is he?
I have to be honest with you. Your son is very ill.
But he's going to be all right.
At this point, we're not sure.
What exactly are his chances?
We're not promising. Even if he does recover, in severe cases of Reye's syndrome, there's a possibility of brain damage. I'm sorry, but I think it's best that you know exactly where we stand.
Thank you, Doctor.
Sure. Thank you.
Despite the bleak prognosis, Nancy and Chuck McGivern refused to give up hope. They moved into the hospital to be closer to their son. They were soon joined in the vigil by other family members who brought religious medals for comfort and healing. Nancy's cousin Jerry gave her a particularly unique ornament, a relic from the robe of St. John Newman, the patron saint of vocations.
You remember when I was in that car crash in Italy? I should have been dead, but this was in my pocket, and I swear it saved my life. I think it might help Chucky, too.
John Newman came to the United States from Bohemia in 1836. He was known as a simple, tireless priest who would ultimately become the fourth bishop of Philadelphia. In 1860, Bishop Newman died. Almost immediately, people began praying to him for favors and blessings. In 1923, a young girl was cured of peritonitis when a picture of the bishop was placed on her abdomen. Before long, a number of miracles had been attributed to Newman. In 1977, John Newman was canonized and declared the first American male saint. Grasping at anything that could offer hope, Nancy McGivern pinned the relics to Chucky's pillow.
Rye syndrome is a buildup of pressure on the brain, and that's why I wanted those medals next to his head. The medals made me feel stronger and gave us more hope.
There you go, Chucky. I'll take good care of you, babe.
The McGiverns had never been especially religious. In fact, they had not been to church in years. But now they found themselves turning to God, praying that their youngest son would not die.
I've never prayed that hard in my life. Never. I mean, I was praying so hard, my blood was sweating down my forehead. Anything but your kid.
Despite the prayers of his family and the efforts of his doctors, Chucky's condition continued to deteriorate.
Lidocaine? After a day or two, his lungs collapsed. Pneumonia set in, and there was two nurses, and they didn't know I was there. In the room, they were behind this door there, and they had an x-ray set up right in his room. And when I came in, I heard them say, "He's not gonna make it."
Chucky's parents could only wait and hope. Little did they know that over the next 48 hours, something truly remarkable was going to occur.
Hey, Chucky.
I noticed that the St. John Newman medal was turned face down on his pillow. So in order to turn this relic back around, I had to unpin it, take off the other ones, and turn the St. John Newman relic around, put it back onto the pin, and put the other ones back on again in order for it to be face up.
Hey, baby.
Next time I came back, it was face down again. Somebody came and kept switching it. As I'm putting it up, somebody was coming in and putting it down. And that's what it was just like, and I thought I was going crazy.
That evening, another intriguing mystery. Someone taped a picture of St. John Newman in Chucky's room. Nancy asked around, but no one knew where it had come from or who had put it there. The next morning, Chucky's father had an odd encounter in the hospital waiting room.
It was 11 o'clock or something like that. And I was watching TV, and all of a sudden this little boy walks in. He looks at everybody in the room. He looks at my wife, and stares at me. I'm staring at him thinking, his parents are gonna come in next. And I'm wondering why is he by himself So that he just looked around, he looked at me again, and he just walked out. So later that day, the nurse comes up and says, "So we had a little incident. We don't want you to get worried, but a little boy came to visit Chucky."
I came to see Chucky.
How did you get in here?
I only wanted to see Chucky.
Wait, come back here. Wait a second. Excuse me, Beth.
Later that day, Chucky received another unexpected visitor, Father Robert Roncase. He had heard about Chucky's plight and felt compelled to administer what is commonly known as the last rites.
So something inside me was saying he needs to be anointed. He needs to receive the sacrament of the sick. It was an overwhelming feeling that I just had to go down and do this. And I left immediately. I went right down that day, right at that moment, to go down to anoint him.
Through this holy anointing, may the Lord in his love and mercy help you with the grace of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
And I do remember when I was anointing Chucky that I could feel that something definitely was happening. I could feel an overwhelming presence of the Spirit, and I could feel that he in some way was receiving grace and strength from God.
Less than an hour later, the unimaginable happened.
Chucky?
Within hours, Chucky would be off of life support and sitting up in bed. To his parents, a miracle had come to pass.
From being very low, where you think, well, my son might die, to he came through it. It was like great. I mean, we were calling everybody on the phone that he was getting better, and you know, but he got better so fast, it was unbelievable.
There you go, Chucky.
Chucky began telling his parents about a bizarre dream he had while unconscious. Incredibly, he described the same young boy that his father and his doctor had seen in the hospital.
What presents, honey?
Well, there were lots of kids in the room giving me presents, and you and Dad were here, too.
I remember when I got up, I was sort of confused because I didn't understand if that was all a dream or did that actually happen. And all these Asian kids would surround me, coming in and out, giving presents of all sorts. But there was one boy in particular who was stayed by my bedside. This boy in my dream was my best friend, and he was like the strength for me, and at all times when I wasn't feeling, like in this dream, when I wasn't maybe not feeling so good, he was there to make sure everything was all right. And he was, I guess he was just like symbolized of the best friend I would have even outside a dream.
1 week after he had lapsed into a coma and a week before Christmas, Chucky McGivern was released from the hospital.
The doctor said they never had anybody so gravely ill recover so fast. And 3 months later, we went back, and they went through everything, and he came out like he was never sick, is what the doctor said, like nothing ever happened to him.
You're coming now into the Shrine of St.
2 weeks after Chucky left the hospital, his parents took him to the Shrine of St. John Newman in Philadelphia.
We have right here the real body of St. John Newman. When he died as Bishop of Philadelphia in 1860, he was brought to St. Peter's Church here to be buried, and for many years, he was under that stone in a crypt.
What is it, honey?
That was my best friend in my dream in the hospital.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm sure. That's him.
The McGiverns were startled when they realized that the portrait was of St. John Newman as a boy.
I was so taken back. I started thinking, it really hit me that something happened here, that St. John Newman interceded for him in some way. There was some kind of a connection there. It's hard to believe, I don't know why. Even now, I don't know, because he's just like any other person. He's just like any other kid at his age. But there must be a reason for it, I don't know.
The reason why St. John Newman came to my aid, I have no idea. That's something I'll never be able to explain. But I know, like, St. John will always, like, be there for me, which is always good. And I know he'll always be, like, near my side.
Did the McGivern family actually experience a Christmas miracle? Or were they the recipients of incredible good luck? Perhaps it doesn't really matter. In the case of this unsolved mystery, a rational explanation is hardly necessary.
Sunday, February 28, 1988, 9 p.m. Firefighters in Odessa, Texas, were called to the scene of an untended trash fire in the parking lot of an abandoned bar. Within minutes, they discovered that in reality, they had been called to the scene of a grisly murder. Buried in the ashes was a charred body of a man who had been beaten and shot twice in the back before being set afire. The victim was identified as 59-year-old Neil Jennings, an RV dealer from Dallas who dabbled in restoring classic cars. As the Odessa police began to look into the death of Neil Jennings, a macabre scenario began to unfold, and they found themselves faced with one of the most bizarre homicide cases they'd ever investigated. The key was a man named Bill Roberts, an enigmatic drifter who worked for Neil Jennings and was apparently the last person to see him alive. On February 26, 1988, Neil Jennings and Bill Roberts stopped off at Neil's brother's house just outside of Dallas.
Neil, this car looks great.
Yeah, Bill helped me restore it. Did a pretty good job. Did a pretty good job. Now listen, you're going
to
help me...
8 weeks earlier, Neil had hired Bill to do the finished details on his latest project, a 1959 Ford Thunderbird.
Tell me about this new guy you hired, Bill.
Bill, he's okay, but I only pay him $50 a week plus room and board.
You're kidding. Well, that keeps him off the street.
In private, Neil let on that he was having financial problems.
Well, sure glad
in fact, he could not even pay Bill the $50 weekly salary he had promised him.
Bill, glad to have met you.
Yeah.
Bye, Nelson.
That Friday evening, Neil and Bill drove 300 miles across the barren Texas prairie to the oil town of Odessa. At 8:30 p.m., they checked into a motel at the edge of town. That would be the last time anyone ever saw Neil Jennings. Not so Bill Roberts. Over the next 48 hours, he was all over Odessa, engaged in a number of suspicious activities. An hour after arriving in town, Bill Roberts showed up at the home of a man named Jack, who had introduced him to Neil a few months earlier.
Hey, Bill, come on in.
Jack.
Jack could not help noticing that Bill was very nervous and sweating profusely.
Jack, can I get a glass of water from you?
Oh, sure you can, Bill. Where's Neil?
We just got back in town. I dropped him off at his lady friend's house. Guess they're having some dinner or something.
Well, here you go.
Thank you.
Well, you sure look like you're out of breath.
Yeah, I had to walk in this little bar down the street. Battery went dead in the truck. I was wondering if you'd give me a jump.
Well, sure I can.
Jack agreed to jump-start the pickup. Bill parked the truck in Jack's backyard and went to sleep in the cab. The next morning, Jack noticed that the truck bed was covered with a tarp. He also noticed that Bill was circling the vehicle in a strange manner, his eyes fixed on the cargo bed.
Hey, how you doing?
10:30 a.m. Saturday. Bill stopped at a rundown motel where he attempted to sell Neil's truck for $1,200.
I'd have to have cash for it, though. Well, that's a nice truck, Bill, but $1,200.
When he found no buyer, Bill asked the residents if he could park the truck in the back of the motel, hidden from view.
I got no problem with that. All right, well, I appreciate that.
All right.
About 6 hours later, at 5 p.m., Bill Roberts returned to the motel.
Listen, I wonder if y'all might have a pick and a shovel I can borrow. I need to fix a broken water line for an old lady.
Sorry about that, Bill. I don't think we have a pick or a shovel around here. Wish I could help you, though.
That's okay. Look, I'll just see y'all a little later then.
Bill then drove the truck to a convenience store less than a mile away.
I was sitting on the store behind the counter, and Bill came in and asked me if he could park the truck behind because he's the truck was overheating.
Thank you. I'm just going
to I said, go ahead.
No problem. All right. Will that be all?
Fifteen minutes later, Saul heard two gunshots in the distance. Another 45 minutes passed, and Bill was back. This time, flashing a large wad of cash.
Thanks again, buddy.
Night.
Later, Bill was seen back at the motel, where he again spent the night in Neil's truck.
Saturday night, he came back and he said he'd done the job. He acted real nervous. And he acted especially nervous whenever he went over there to get something out of the truck that had a tarp on it.
How are you, Bill?
All right.
The next morning, another odd encounter.
Would it be okay if I did some laundry?
And I noticed that blood was on his shirt. Well, I didn't think anything about it because, you know, it just looked like maybe he cut himself and wiped it off on his shirt.
Follow me and I'll show you how to use this washer.
So I told him, okay, you know, yeah, you can use the laundry.
A few minutes later, another resident noticed a small amount of blood on the back bumper of Neil's pickup. Around noon, Bill left the motel and never returned. 8 hours later, the police were on the scene of the trash fire.
Our investigation at the scene showed there was two pools of blood. We found shotgun shell casings and wadding there at the scene. There was drag marks leading from the parking lot over to the concrete slab where Neil was actually found on fire. There's no doubt in her mind that the fatal shots happened in that parking lot.
Sheriff's deputies now believe that Bill Roberts shot Neil Jennings on Saturday night and hid his body in a trash heap. For some unknown reason, he waited 24 hours and then returned to set Neil's body on fire. Roberts' apparent motive? To murder Neil Jennings so that he could steal his truck and sell it.
The thing that makes this case so strange to us is we know Neil got here Friday night. He was with Bill. Neil was never seen again after Friday night. Now, Saturday morning, we've got Bill by himself in the truck. Saturday evening, we've got Saul hearing the gunshots. And Sunday evening is when the body was actually found due to the fire. The question is, where was Neil from Friday night until Sunday? You know, when did the murder actually take place?
In the course of their investigation, police learned that Bill Roberts was actually Bill Blackwell, who had served time for larceny and theft. He was wanted by the Texas Department of Corrections on a parole violation. Authorities determined that Bill Blackwell left Odessa within 24 hours of setting the fire. He then drove to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where he sold Neil's truck in a flea market. He has not been seen since. Next, the strange odyssey of a little girl kidnapped in 1986. Gallup, New Mexico, 140 miles west of Albuquerque, lies within what was for centuries the territory of a Navajo Indian nation. On April 6, 1986, this quiet community of 18,000 was rocked by the mysterious disappearance of a 9-year-old Navajo girl, Antoinette Calladito.
She's not in the living room.
When her mother and two sisters awoke that morning, they were surprised to discover that Antoinette was not in the house.
We went looking for around the house, nothing.
Antoinette!
I didn't start panicking until we checked with all the neighbors, went to every house, and nobody had no sight seen of her. and that's when I panicked.
Penny Calladito's neighbors fanned out through the surrounding foothills looking for Antoinette. For 3 days, they searched along with the police, but no one found a trace of the little girl. Authorities were almost certain she had been kidnapped. The days stretched into weeks, then months. Police could offer little to bolster Penny's hopes of ever finding her daughter alive. Finally, after a year had passed and all seemed lost, a dramatic call for help came into the Gallup police station.
I'm Antoinette Calladito.
Okay, whereabouts in Albuquerque?
Before the girl could answer, the call was abruptly ended by an unidentified man.
He said he could use a phone.
Hello?
Antoinette, where are you? Antoinette?
Detectives played a recording of the call for Penny Calladito. If the voice was indeed her daughter's, it would be an agonizing glimmer of hope.
I listened to that tape over and over and over. And just by the way she says her last name and the way she screamed, sent chills all over my body. Because a mother knows, and I know that was her.
She knew that was her daughter's voice on that tape, and she just couldn't figure out who the male's voice was in the background and where Antoinette was at. We know Antoinette had indicated that she was in Albuquerque, but the call was so short that it couldn't even be traced as to what line it was coming from.
The phone call nourished renewed hopes for Antoinette's safe return. However, 4 torturous years passed without any further clues. Once again, authorities began to fear that she would never be found alive. In desperation, the FBI finally released 2 computer-enhanced photographs showing what Antoinette might look like at the age of 14. 4 months later, the last-ditch effort paid off. A possible sighting of Antoinette was reported in Carson City, Nevada, 870 miles from Gallup.
A waitress at a restaurant in Carson City told the Carson City police about a strange incident that she had witnessed that particular day.
Okay, 3 cheeseburgers.
She waited on a table at which sat a male and a female, rather unkempt, and a small girl about the age of 14 or 15. The little girl would deliberately drop a utensil on the floor. The waitress put the utensil back on the table, and the little girl grabbed her hand and squeezed it hard. And the waitress thought nothing of it and went about her business. The threesome left the restaurant, and the waitress went and back to the table and began to bust the table. She lifted up the plate belonging to the girl, and underneath was a napkin that said, "Please help me, call the police." By the time she realized what had happened, the couple and the girl were gone.
1 month after the Carson City sighting, detectives re-interviewed Antoinette's younger sister, Wendy, who was 5 years old when Antoinette disappeared. Now 10, Wendy made a stunning revelation.
Wendy, we went to Wendy's school with the intention of just talking to her about what her recollections were of that particular night.
There was a knock at the door, and then Antoinette went to go answer, and then I followed her.
Who's there?
Open up.
Who's there?
Uncle Joe, open up.
She goes, "Who is that?" And then they say, "Uncle Joe." So she opened the door and they grabbed her. She started kicking and she goes, "Let me go, let me go." And then they took her to a van, a brown van.
Did you see what these guys look like?
No, I didn't see the faces.
Wendy, why didn't you tell anybody about what you saw that night?
Because I thought, since my mom was crying and everything, I thought I'd get in trouble.
I strongly believe that she was fearful in that people would think that for a five-year-old, she's just making stories up. You know, I don't believe she's making this up. I strongly feel that she's telling us the truth with that.
Uncle Joe, at that time in 1986, was Penny's brother-in-law. He was married to Penny's sister. We recently interviewed him, and he provided an alibi and a witness corroborating his alibi, and he is not a suspect.
I believe that the people that took Antoinette are not family members, but is somebody that is close to the family. Otherwise, Antoinette would not have opened that door had they not stated that it was her Uncle Joe. I strongly believe that somebody had to have known who Uncle Joe was and had to have known what to say to get Antoinette to open up that door.
Finally, Penny Calladito turned to her own Native American heritage in the search for Antoinette. She and her other daughters visited a respected Navajo medicine woman skilled in performing traditional tribal ceremonies. Unsolved Mysteries was allowed to film portions of the crystal ritual, or as it is called in Navajo, Des Chi. It is a centuries-old rite with a specific purpose of contacting the spirit of a missing person. According to the medicine woman, Antoinette is still alive and may have a child. She is being held against her will by threats of violence far from any city, somewhere in the Southwest. Detectives were amazed that additional information provided by the medicine woman was consistent with elements of their own investigation.
Going to the medicine lady gives me a lot of strength, and it helps me to just know that she is alive. I want her to be safe wherever she is. No matter who she's with, they got to have some compassion not to hurt another human being, as small as she is. And I pray that God will help guide her and help guide all of us to keep the strength to go on to find her and bring her home safe.
When we return, a series of anonymous gifts shows a Florida couple that no good deed goes unrewarded. Around Christmas time, even the most hard-boiled among us seems to soften up, to look for the best in others, to give more freely of ourselves. It's a time when we begin to hope for little miracles. This is a story of a simple good deed, which in a charming and mysterious way returned itself 500-fold. The setting is not the snow and ice and fir trees of the north, but rather the palm trees, balmy breezes, and blue waters of Florida. Behind its ritzy facade, Florida harbors a very different subculture of retired couples living on meager fixed incomes. Gene and Russell Johnson are just such a couple. Russell, a former fire chief in Wayne, Michigan, was forced to retire after a severe heart attack. Now Russell spends most days in his workshop building custom dollhouses and repairing church organs. Gene is a homemaker who raised four children before she and Russell moved to Florida. Despite some continuing health problems, the Johnsons were managing to make ends meet, and their lives were routine and uneventful until the winter of 1985.
Well, this day started out about the same as any other day down here. It was in November, and it was unusually warm, as I remember it, and humid. When I was working out in the shop, it was about 10:30 in the morning. All of a sudden, the door of the house came open, and Gene came out in, frightened, scared.
There's a man outside.
Where's he went?
He said he wanted some work for something to eat.
It's out here in front?
Yeah.
Okay.
Did
Do you have any work that I could do to get something to eat? I'm really hungry.
No, I don't have any work for you to do. But you sure won't leave here hungry. Do you have anything to make a sandwich out of?
I can make a sandwich.
Well, usually we don't have much for lunch, you know. Order. But we just happened to go in to town, got some lunch meat, and so I had lots of stuff to feed them.
How about a glass of iced tea, cold?
That would taste real good.
Jan, would you bring a glass of iced tea? Make it two glasses. I'll have one with them. You look tired. Would you like a chair to sit down?
Yes.
The stranger had asked for help from a couple who had very little themselves. Russell had recently undergone open-heart surgery, and Gina successfully battled cancer. Their financial resources were depleted. Nevertheless, they were willing to share what they had.
Tired?
Yeah, well, come a long way, you know.
Where are you from?
I'm from Houston, and there are no jobs out there. And
just talking with them,
came hitchhiking here.
You could tell the man was not a bum.
Had no luck being picked up at all.
He was very articulate in his speech, friendly, and basically a gentleman.
Thank you, thank you. Very good.
He may have been down on his luck, but he was no bum. He ate quite a while. I think probably he had about three sandwiches to begin with. And then he rested a bit and had some more tea. He was just really too tired to talk. So we just sat there and kept him company. After a period of time, I would say 5 minutes or so, he said, well, he says, I guess I better be on my way.
Thank you for giving me.
Lots of luck on your job.
Thank you.
Just a minute. Do you have any money?
13 cents.
I reached in my pocket and I had some change. And Gene turned at that time, went back in the house, hit the hypothetical sugar bowl. And she came up with some change and another dollar bill. And I imagine the man probably gave him about $5.
Any?
And as we gave it to him, we noticed his eyes. There was just such a sparkle of life came back into them. And he just reacted so differently. He didn't seem to be the man that he was when we first talked with him.
Thank you.
And that was only a matter of everything within a half an hour.
God bless you.
Well, as he said that, the strangest feeling came over Gene and I. Just feeling of such goodness and love.
Go through the back to the pool.
Gene and Russell Johnson walked through their house, into the garage, then out onto a side porch. They wanted to wave to their visitor one last time.
Where is he?
He was nowhere to be seen.
Are we losing it? We walked back through the garage. Nobody. We walked out to the street, looked both ways, walked out to the main street in front of our house. Nobody.
The mysterious stranger had vanished as quickly as he appeared, yet the special warmth Gene and Russell Johnson felt lingered.
Oh, this is a nice one.
They began to remark, half in jest, that perhaps they had been visited by an angel. Then, about 10 days before Christmas, the Johnsons received an anonymous card.
Like somebody's playing a trick.
Good. Huh? Your Christian friend.
The check for $500. I don't believe this.
$500? Well, we don't know any friends that have that kind of money to give away, especially anonymously. Love your Christian friends. Ned looked at Jean. She was crying. What's the matter?
Can't believe it.
But it hit at a very opportune time because we didn't have anything.
Well, sure, you had the right time.
And the only remark that I could make at the time was, has to be our angel.
Good morning, Russ. Jean, how are you today?
Hi. Real good, Ernie.
Good. How can I help you?
Well, we've got a bit of a problem, perhaps. We got this in the mail, and we think it might be a practical joke. And if we didn't know you, I don't think we even try to cash it.
Really?
Is it any good?
Take a look at it. Good as gold, Russ. How would you like it?
Something. Put it in the checking account, Ernie.
I'll do it right now.
We couldn't believe it. We tried to check to see if there's somebody that we knew that could have sent it. We looked at the postmarks, where it was from. We checked handwritings. And we'd say to everybody, if you sent this, thank you. But nobody did.
The following Christmas, another anonymous card arrived. It was signed, Your Friend. It contained another $500 check. The next three Christmases brought three more checks and three more cards, all mailed from the Orlando area. Gene and Russell Johnson have never been able to find out who their benefactor is, but they have a pretty good idea.
We've often thought back. We took $5 that we didn't have and gave to somebody that needed it more. We don't know if there's any connection. But in return, from somewhere, we've gotten $500 for 5 years.
God bless you.
Could it be from our angel? We don't know. We have no identification, but we would like to say thank you to somebody. It was a gift well received.
Did the Johnsons experience a Christmas miracle? Perhaps. Or perhaps they simply experienced the everyday miracle of kindness, which is never out of season. From all of us at Unsolved Mysteries, I'd like to extend to you and your family our best wishes for a safe, happy holiday. Join me next time. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery.